Los Altos Hills. And here's Johnny's theme.
He really found me.
Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis.
Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis. Johnny Otis.
Everyone, this is Johnny Otis, and that means it's time to rock. Yes, and it's time to roll. And we're gonna get way back in the alley with the blues.
In this next segment, we're going to move into work Johnny did with other artists, as he had done in the beginning of his career with a lot of jazz, big bands. He has started working with R&B artists and doing production or writing or any number of things. And one of those artists said he helped out early on, Etta James. We're going to hear Etta talk about that experience with Johnny and hear the track that they worked on together.
He really found me because at that time, I had ran away from home, and I went and I stayed with two girls, one named Abby and Jean, who later became the Peaches. You know, it used to be Etta James and the Peaches. We had wrote an answer to the song "Work with Me, Annie."
The Hank Ballard record.
Right. So during those days, you know, everybody would make an answer. You'd said, "Work with me, Annie." Then we'd said, "Roll with me, Henry." And so one night, the young girl and myself, we were the same age. I think we were both like 16. And the older sister was like 24. And she went out to a dance in the Fillmore district, which was, you know, a heavy drag district of San Francisco. She went to see the Johnny Otis band. All of a sudden, we got a call that night, and it was Abby calling us back to say, "Listen, guess who I'm with? I'm with Johnny Otis." And we go, "Oh, Johnny Otis." And he said, "Yeah, Johnny Otis. I told him that we have a girl group, and he says he wants to hear us." And I said, "Yeah, right." And she says, "Oh, he's at the hotel there, and all the band and everything." And myself and the girl, we looked at each other and said, "Yeah, right. Now we're 15-year-olds, and we're going to go to the hotel with the band and Johnny Otis." Johnny Otis was like about a 34, 35-year-old man. So we said, "Oh, no, that's all right. That's all right. We'll cool that and everything." So Johnny Otis snatched the phone from her. And it was Johnny Otis. You know, we heard that voice, you know. And he said, "Hi, how you doing?" And we said, "Oh, we're doing all right." He says, I hear you guys got a great group. I hear you got a couple of songs, and I'd like to hear you." And he says, "How about catching a cab? I'll pay the cab fare, and I'll meet you out front." He said, "Don't worry. Nobody's going to bother." He says, "Okay." So we got up and got dressed, got in the cab, and went down there. Sure enough, as we pulled up, we saw this tall man. You know, we'd all seen pictures of Johnny Otis with the nice hair, and he looked like a tall, kind of like a Creole man with a nice mustache and a beard, and he had, you know, and the nice pompadour hair. And when we got there, he said, "Oh, I'm glad to see you, and come on up and let's hear you." So we went upstairs to his room and we sang "How Deep Is the Ocean" and "For All We Know" and "Street of Dreams." There, my mother, I knew my mother wasn't going to let me go, but I told him. He says, "How old are you?" I said, 18, which he knew that was a lie. And he says, "Well, you know what? I would like to take you guys to Los Angeles tomorrow to make a record." And he says, "Can I speak with your mother?" I said, "No, I can't find her right now. She's working." And he says, "Well, can you go home and get permission from your mother, get something in writing stating that you can travel and you're allowed to travel with me and have her to sign it and date it?" I said, "Oh, yeah, I can do that." So sure enough, that's what I did. I went home. I wrote the note, brought the note back with a tiny little bag, a little plastic bag or something with some clothes in it, and myself and the two girls got on Johnny's bus and we split to L.A.
"Hey, baby, what do I have to do to make you love me too?
I got to roll with me, Henry.
All right, baby.
Roll with me, Henry.
Don't mean maybe.
Roll you ain't moving me, you better feel that boogie beat. Get the leg out of your feet. Roll with me, Henry. Roll with me, Henry.
Rehearsal. We're getting ready to go on the road. And there's a little kid. And Mr. Otis, could I do a song for you? I said, well, wait, son. Mr. Otis, could I do a song? He said, wait. And we had barbecued a goat. I remember that. And we were eating barbecue. And while we're eating, he wouldn't eat. I said, go on and eat, pal. He said, well, aren't you going to let me sing? I said, as soon as we eat, you can eat. You can sing. So he ate. And I had written a song for Red Light called Cry Baby. Supposed to have been a Charles Brown type thing. Well, they call me Cry Baby. Red Light couldn't get it. I said, okay, you heard us trying to do this song, right? And his name was Melvin Lightsey. He said, yeah. He said, I think I could do that. So I said, and he did, man. The first boom, right on. I said, hey, wait a minute. You wait a minute. Hold it right there. So then I called Lester. I said, let's see if he can sing Double Crossing Blues. See, Mel Walker did not make Double Crossing Blues. Bobby Nunn did. And he sang it, and better, because he was, you know, a greater, more resonant voice in the blues feeling. So that's how we found Mel Walker. And I changed his name to my wife's last name, because Lightsey was kind of an awkward name. So I said, hey, I'll give you Phyllis's maiden name, Walker, Mel Walker. Yeah, so we went on the road, and while on the road, I found Linda Hopkins. I don't know if you ever saw any of those records. And Little Sylvia. I don't know if you've ever heard of those records, Orm Savoy, which were done with my band. And she was Sylvia, Mickey and Sylvia. Sure. And then there was Willa Mae Thornton, about 62. I was in Houston, and Don Roby, the promoter there who owns Peacock, told me, said, I wanted you to hear some things tonight. And he brought a lot of talent up, things he had signed that he intended to record. And I was impressed with two, but only two that I could actually. I said, listen, I said, you got two things there that I really like. Now, Marie Adams had already was writing on a kind of a hit called Honky Tonks.
I like that.
Yeah. But Willa Mae had never recorded. And he said, well, I said, look, I'll take that big broad. I'm going to take her with me. He said, go ahead. Fine. So we took her. And I was told she'll do great in the South, but she, they probably won't understand her. But one of the next jobs was Boston. And she fractured everybody in the joint. I said, this thing is not reasonable.
What kind of things was she singing
blues
at that point?
Blues. That's all we did in those days. Yeah. Fast blues and slow blues, and blues ballads, Since I Fell for You or something. Yeah. That's all we did.
Yeah.
It was while I was with the Savoy, and later while I was signed to Mercury. Mm-hmm. That's why you'll notice on Willa Mae Thornton's Hound Dog record, instead of my name being on it, Kansas City Bill, it says. Should have read Kansas City Bell.
Right.
You know, that's a typographical error. Yeah. But I couldn't put my name on because I was signed to Mercury.
Right.
You ain't nothing but a hound. Been snooping around the door. You ain't nothing but a hound dog. And
We did the Hound Dog was one of the things we did under that arrangement.
Yeah.
Where they'd write things and I would edit them and rewrite them and we'd record them. And everything was fine. Willa Mae's record came out and sold about 500,000. Fine. But then Elvis Presley's record came out and sold 6 million and somebody told them that they were underage at the time and that there's a legal maneuver they could pull called disaffirm the contract and they could cut me out completely. And they did. You know, we did things on Mercury together. They knew better. That was all resolved anyhow way before that disaffirmation came through. But you know, I did get $1,300 for Hound Dog as against I think $150,000 that I should have gotten.
Well, girl, you're so fine. So fine. You're so fine. So fine. My baby's so doggone fine. She loves me come rain, come shine.
Cheeks with So Fine, a song Johnny wrote, and that was out, let's see,
it's like 1955
on the Federal label. And we also heard Big Mama Thornton with her version, the song Hound Dog, of course made rather popular by a white artist later, but that version, Hound Dog, written by Lieber and Stoller and possibly Johnny. We don't really know exactly what went down, but everybody seems to be convinced to have a piece of that song. And that was on Peacock. Johnny was sort of doing a production deal with Peacock while he was a recording artist on Mercury, all at the same time.
We know that in that recording that Lieber and Stoller wrote the lyrics around the hook that Pete Lewis, the guitar player on that track, was playing. And we talked about Pete Lewis earlier, and this is probably the last time we're going to hear from Pete Lewis. Pete Lewis, who was hanging around the club scene down there in South Central LA, and Johnny picked up on his talent. I believe he was at one of the talent nights that they had at the Barrel House. Stayed with Johnny until 1955, and then disappeared. And in fact, he pretty much died penniless in Watts, probably. We're not for certain, but Johnny Otis said the last time he saw Pete Lewis was a wino down in Watts in 1965. It's kind of a sad ending for such a great amount of talent.
Yeah, a really, really aggressive style. Really not exactly what other guitar players were playing. He was actually having some of a distorted sound very early on. And, all this stuff is really, this is all sort of pre-rock and roll. We're just getting to the stage where rock and roll is about to become an accepted style of music in the mainstream, but we're not quite there yet. So really, this is really R&B, and there's some of the flavor of doo-wop there, particularly on the tracks that we heard from the Sheiks. Johnny tended to learn and, in some cases, master almost any style that came his way from the various black music makers that he heard. And I have to say, some of them were more successful than others, but he really did have his finger on the pulse of things. And I think that he wanted to remain contemporary, and that took him quite some distance. It wasn't until the 60s when he kind of lost his way, because the music had just sort of moved on ahead of him. But at this point, he's right there in the middle of it all. And the other track we heard of him working with another artist in this last segment was Etta James, Roll With Me Henry. And of course, she moved on to kind of her version of R&B and eventually was very much accepted as a mainstream artist. But Johnny was right there at the start. So at this period of time, we should tell you who we are. I'm Art Crimes.
I'm John Goldfarb.
And you're listening to Brother from Another Planet, the Johnny Otis story. And we're here till 10 p.m., and so far, I think we're running right on schedule, so I'm hoping we can cover everything we intended to do. This next segment, Johnny has left the Savoy label. He's got a short contract with Mercury, and so he's recording for Mercury, but he's doing production deal with Peacock, and then he will actually move over and do some releases on Peacock. This will get us through the middle of the 50s, and once again, we're right on the cusp of what will become rock and roll very soon. Let's see. So we're going to hear one of the tracks that he cut for... which one is this? Is it the Mercury or Peacock side? It's one of his hits of that period of time. Call Operator 210. And once again, that's Mel Walker singing this track. He stayed with Johnny through these label changes. And then Johnny will talk a little bit about the Mercury Peacock era. And also talk about a pretty famous jazz artist who he cut a track with during that time.
I've asked you like a lady to stop your running round. You're up to your old tricks. All the days you me up. I've been acting tame, but if you don't show up tonight, you'll never be the same. I'm gonna change your mind, Daddy.
I'm too big for you to mess with, so don't bruise your little hips.
But I'll get you, Daddy, if I have to make two trips. I'm gonna change your mind, Daddy. Track.
And if you fool with me, Mama, you'll have trouble getting back. I'm gonna change your mind, baby, if you don't change your ways. You better bring it to my door, or don't bring it home anymore, anymore, anymore. Now come on and kiss your dad. That's it.
Hello?
Hello, Mel.
Hello, baby. Why did you wait so long to call? So long to go. Well, I've been so sick and worried ever since you left last fall.
One night in Gary, Indiana, I looked out in the audience and I saw our agent, Ben Bart, who later became James Brown's personal manager and died recently, incidentally. Mm-hmm. I saw him standing with a couple of guys who looked like they might be something in the industry, you know. Green and Talmadge, I think it was, of Mercury.
Art Talmadge.
And Herb Green. I think that's who they were. Yeah. And out of that, you know, they were impressed with what they saw. And we had a little success. We had Operator 210, which was a cover of Floyd Dixon's record, which
was
did well.
Cover? Was it? I never heard that.
Yeah, it was a cover. It was really a cover. Yeah. That was Bobby Shadd's idea. And it turned out to be a good one because we got mileage on that. And did some things with Ben Webster that I always liked. We used Ben Webster. Ben had never recorded with a blues band. It was really quite an experience for him. He loved the guitar sound and the boogie piano and all that. And the vibe mixed in with the guitar, that he liked that, and he really blew. He harkened back to something because he kept telling me, he said, you know, that reminds me of, and he was half drunk, and he kept it. So something back in his background, that was really getting to him, and the guitar player knocked him out. Mm-hmm. And he was honking and blowing, you know, that great thing he does. And then we did one jazz, then we did Stardust, where he played, and the two of us, he and I.
Bring grandma too. Sisters in the yard hollering, ooby. dooby dooby doo dooby 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 doo. That's all you gotta do. Papa bought a rooster, thought it was a hen. Waited 2 years for the eggs to begin. Said, look here, bird, what you gonna do? The rooster looked up and said, ooby dooby doo, ooby dooby dooby doo, ooby dooby dooby doo, ooby dooby dooby doo, ooby dooby dooby doo, ooby doo, ooby doo. That's all you gotta do.
Whoopie-doo. That's one of the tracks that he cut for the Mercury label during his 1 year and some change contract with them, right before he went to record officially for Peacock. And that was Johnny singing the lead on that track. He doesn't always sing lead on these tunes because he usually had those great vocalists to do the job for him. But once in a while, he'd come out and sing a number. He was not very confident about his own voice, but I think that... it did give some variety to the various tunes they were putting out if he sang one once in a while. And Stardust featuring Ben Webster, very uncharacteristic sound for that era. That was, you know, mid-50s, and Johnny was kind of going back to the ballroom era with that one a bit. And Call Operator 210, as Johnny mentioned, that was a something of a hit for him in this time period. And we had a bonus track there from 1950 that snuck in. Deceiving Blues with the team of
aptly named
Mel and Little Esther doing what they do so well with those little asides. Next segment we're getting to is actually one that's dear to our hearts because Johnny was among all the other things we've talked about, producing, songwriting, performing, singing. He was also a radio and eventually a radio personality and eventually a television personality as well for some number of years, based in the L.A. area. He'll talk a little bit about how he got started on that and why he wanted a job that he could stay at home doing that kind of work and maybe just take the band out locally but not doing these cross-country jaunts anymore. And you know, he had a very, very long, actually, radio career, but we'll hear some bits of that later. Right now, this period of time, he's on a commercial radio station, K-Fox, which is strangely similar to a station we have around here. Let's see. And, I need to get my info here from Mr. Goldfarb. This collection came out on Ace that has samples of his radio and television shows, and so it's nice because they actually left the commercials that Johnny did and his various band members would do occasionally, and so you get the whole flavor of what the show was like. So we'll actually hear maybe four or five selections from this Johnny Otis Show vintage 1950s broadcast from Los Angeles out on Ace. Ace is your go-to label for all things Johnny Otis because they have maybe 10 collections out on various portions of Johnny's career. Not that we're getting any money from Ace, but just wanted you to know where you can find a lot of this stuff. The Ace catalog is really top-notch as far as covering Johnny's career all through the 50s and not much beyond, actually. It seems like the later stuff is still on the labels that they came out originally. But all these things that came out of Mercury and Peacock and this radio show stuff is now compiled by Ace. So we'll hear a section that was aired on K-Fox down in Southern California, not to be confused with any other K-Fox you might be thinking about. This probably runs a few minutes, so it's about maybe 10 or 12 minutes, and there's some chit-chat and some songs with Johnny Otis here on KFJC.
Yeah. you, Marie Adams. Thank you, Johnny Otis. Thank you, nice people, for being here. Thank you, everybody, for even listening. And this time, it's midnight in the Barrel House. And here's Ed Rice. And Ed Rice on guitar. I meant to say on the guitar. And of course, you know, you're at the 5-4 Ballroom. Right here on the stage is Johnny Otis and his great aggregation, not forgetting, of course, Marie Adams, vocalist. She in herself is a big show. So if you care to come on down, we'll make room for you. It's a little bit crowded, but you won't mind that. Well, now we go again. This time it's Johnny Otis himself in All Night Long.
Hey, Mr. Landlord, you can lock that door. Pull the lights down low, pull the rug off the floor. Nobody answer if you hear a knock. Just grab your baby and rock.
All night long.
All night long, all night
long, all night long, like it all night long.
Hey everybody, let's get it on. Life is short, so let's have some fun. Forget about tomorrow, turn back the clock. Let's get together and rock.
All night long, all night long, all night long.
Rock it all night long. as a kite.
Why?
Cops ain't coming out this time of night. The joint is jumping, let the good times roll and satisfy your soul.
All night long. All night long. All night long.
No clown. Hey, hey, don't. Watch your chick, you sound. Don't do that, man. That lady got something to knock you out.
What?
Her husband. Better leave her alone. Rockin' all night
Johnny Otis, thank you. That was great. And now we keep jumping along. This time it's Arthur Matthews. He says, I didn't know.
I'm getting sick and tired of the way you do. A good kind papa, I'm not bothering you. Just sprinkle a goop of dust all around your bed. Wake up one of these mornings and find your own self dead. She said you shouldn't say that. I say, what should I say this time? Baby. She said, I don't know. My, oh my, oh my. I love, she got dimples in her jaws. The clothes she's wearing's made out of the best of cloth. She can take and wash them and hang them upside the wall. Throw them out the window and run out and catch them a little bit before they fall. Sometimes I think you got your habits on. She said you shouldn't say that. I said, what should I say this time? She said, I don't know. My, oh my, oh my. I don't know what my baby couldn't die. Sit down and cry. Say to young man's son, to have the many women you got. I looked at my mother dear, didn't even crack a smile. I said, if these women kill me, I don't mind dying. The woman I love, I won a week before last. The woman I love, I run out of class. I thought I warned you, baby, a long time ago. If you don't watch your step, I'm gonna have to let you go. She said you shouldn't say that. I said, what should I say this time? She said,
Thank you. You were very nice.
Pat, what I got fed up with was the road. One Christmas, I was in New York, and I called home, and we had, you know, little two phones where the children were on one, and my wife and my father on the other. We're all trying to say, talk to each other. And my girls, you'll meet them. They were little. They were, you know, like 2 and 3 at the time. And one of them said, Daddy, you're never home at Christmas like other daddies is. So I don't have to tell you, you're a father. That kind of something said cling in my mind. And if that didn't cinch it, about 2 days later, we were going over the Blue Ridge Mountains and with tire chains, and we saw a car in front of us just slide and go right into the river through the ice and disappear. And then we banged into another car, and it was such a shake-up. I said, now that did it. The kids tell me I'm not at home like other daddies, and this crap's got to go. So I said, I'm going home. I don't know what I'm going to do because I don't know what else I can do. But I just said, you know, when I get home, I'm going to try to make some plans. Mm-hmm. And the first thing, I got home, I said, I want to be a disc jockey. Hell, they don't have to worry about producing hit records. They just play everybody else's hits. And maybe I could do that here in L.A. So I opened the Yellow Pages, and I just saw radios, and I just put my finger down, bang, and it fell on KFOX. So I called up KFOX. I said, hello, may I speak to the manager? I said, I didn't know about program directors. He said, well, this I'm the manager and the program director. My name is Hal Scheidler. I later got to be a dear friend of mine. I said, listen, this is Johnny Otis, and I want to be a disc jockey. Just like that. That was corny and stupid. He said, and he chuckled. He says, this is Johnny Otis, the Duke Ellington of Watts. And luckily, he knew me, see. And so I laughed. I said, yeah, that's who it is. He said, well, listen, come out here right now. So I went out there, and sure enough, I got a radio show. And that's,
wow.
Yeah.
Great.
And out of that grew the TV show, and I was able to stay home and play gigs. You know, that started the rock and roll era. I thought nothing but black people were listening. But I got the shock of my life the first gig we played. We went to San Diego and played a thing.
What do you mean you played a thing? I didn't mean you.
I kept my band together.
Yeah.
I started playing in black clubs here on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Thursday. We played the nightlife, the Harlem Hotspot in San Pedro. And this is, the radio show kept me alive. We were playing these joints and packing them and didn't have to leave town.
Yeah, great.
You dig it?
Yeah.
So I said, I think we'll go to San Diego because this station covers San Diego well. So I produced a spot myself. I had a little recording studio. Now I want to go to the record business side in my garage, just like you saw, you know. And so I made these tapes and I spliced and put them together so it said, and ladies and gentlemen, you'll see Mel Williams. And I had him sing a little bit of the record. And then I said, and Little Arthur Matthews, a little bit of that one. And Julie's, well, whoever I had, I forget who it was, Marie Adams. And it sounded like a big package, see? So I played it every day on the show. And we go to San Diego to a place called the only place we could find that we could rent was a place called the skating rink. And we didn't need that much room. That place held 7,000 people. But, you know, it's nothing else. But we got it cheap, and there's nowhere else. But, you know, we packed that, and it was almost all white. Black kids were there, but there were so many more because whites outnumbered blacks, and all the Mexican kids were there, and the white kids were there. And I said, and it happened that my program director had come with me, Hal Scheidler, and he saw that, and the next day he went right to Channel 11, the KTTV, and told him, said, you better put this on television, because it's a phenomenal thing that you're not aware of. I wasn't either. He said, something's happening here. Yeah. It's called rock and roll, and you don't know what that is either, but you better put it on. So the guy says, look, he said, we don't have no time. So he thought, he said, I'll tell you what, he said, you want to go on against the $64,000 question? Are you aware of what that was?
Yeah, yeah.
That was the blockbuster of all time.
Yeah, yeah.
And so Hal said, no, my God, what do you want to do, kill us? So he said, well, that's it. And that's all he had. And I said, well, look, we'll take it. So we took it. And we, look, the kids had just discovered something. And against the $64,000 question, that was quite an accomplishment. And that's how we got on TV. And I had the band, you know, live, and everybody who came to town, Ray Charles, the Moonglows, everybody who came to town would do a shout on the Johnny Otis show. Great. Sam Cooke and all of them, you know.
And so he started that new career as a DJ. It makes it sound pretty easy. That'd be nice. That'd be nice if you could just get a radio job by calling a guy up and saying, hey, I want to do a radio show.
No resume.
But you know, Johnny was well suited to this because he did have that enthusiasm, and he had the voice, and he had the swinging hipster patter. Everybody's a cat or a chick, and can you dig it? And that actually worked rather well for a while. And this period of time, he's now at this point, he's left Peacock. He started his own label, and he's inclined to do this throughout the rest of his career, start his own label for a period of time and then shut it down and then start up another one. So he started a label called Dig, which was totally appropriate for a cool cat hipster like Johnny, Dig Records. And Dig not only served as an outlet for his own recordings, but also he was doing his talent scouting and releasing sides by other artists as well. And so he had a little empire. I don't know how many releases came out on Dig, but it must have been on the order of 50 or so, because there's so many compilations of the Dig masters now. He would stick with Dig for a little while, and then when that got to be a little too hectic, he picked up a contract with Capitol. So we're going to hear one of the tracks that came out on Dig. This was a two-sider, Midnight Creeper Part 1 and Part 2. We'll just hear the first part, but it gives you a great sense of where Johnny was at. As he went on, his band kind of got a little bit smaller and smaller and tighter, and so some of these tracks are very, very small numbers of instruments playing, but it actually makes it sound all the more cooler, because you could hear every little note. So here's a instrumental, Midnight Creeper, out in 1956 on the Dig label.